Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome to Film Fandango, the film podcast. My name's David Reed. This is Marek Larwood.
Hello, my name is Marek Larwood. And if you want to hear two men talk about films, you're in luck. If you don't, piss off.
Nicely done. Nicely done.
It is now September. Good films are starting to come out again. But because of the summer lull and because of the recent spate of deaths in the film industry, we thought we'd do a special about someone who's sort of quite big for British film, Sir Richard Attenborough.
Yes.
I mean, it's going to be one of those things that happens now. There's so many celebrities, I think we talked about this before, that it's going to be a dead celebrity every day for the next...
Well, we've lost a couple of good ones recently, haven't we, in terms of, you know, good creative output. I mean, Rick Mayall was the first to go. Not huge in cinema, but American Werewolf in London. I'm a big fan of Drop Dead Fred. Whoops Apocalypse, he's in. Then Robin Williams, I think we talked about briefly as well. You know, some fantastic movies there.
Yeah.
So, and Joan Rivers, of course, who voiced the robot in Spaceballs.
Yes, there's a lot of people who have died. So I think what inspired this is I was watching a documentary on Richard Attenborough on, the life of Richard Attenborough on BBC, and I thought, I didn't realise... that he'd his famous film was probably he's best known for playing Pinky in Brighton Rock.
Yes.
And more recently his sort of comeback as an actor as the Doctor in Jurassic Park, whatever he was called.
Hammond, yeah, and then Miracle on 34th Street where he played Santa. That's his old man sort of white beardy sort of roles, isn't
yeah.
it? But he's in his youth he did some fantastic work. I mean it's Great Escape.
And also he took a big lull to become to become a producer and director. And I haven't really seen many films he's directed. He was known as, well, Bridge Too Far is one. Young Winston I watched ages ago, which is strangely really enjoyable. His films also seem to make statements. What a Lovely War, which is supposed to be an odd musical. And I watched the one I hadn't seen, Chorus Line, which is supposed to be alright, Cry Freedom. And the one I'd seen, his big one, is probably Gandhi. He won all the Oscars for, and it was a big project of his. And apparently, one of his first cinematic experiences was going to watch the old newsreels in the 1930s, I can't remember when. He was about 8-9 years old. So, 1930s. And he saw footage of Gandhi who came over to England to talk to all the mill workers and had him in his sort of, you know, just loincloth and his... blanket, and everyone in the cinema laughed, and his dad told him, you know, don't laugh, that man's a great man. And he became sort of a little bit not obsessed, but one of his interests was Gandhi and the fact he changed, you know, helped get independence for India. So it became his project, and he thought no one would be interested in making it, and he spent a long time trying to raise money for that and eventually got it made. And that's a fascinating story, and I've not seen the film before. It's one that shot Ben Kingsley to fame.
Yeah, I mean, Ben Kingsley's performance is fantastic in it. I mean, and it a hell of a thing to do for such a national hero to have that part played by a foreigner, basically. They weren't happy when it was first announced, and then, when they actually started filming and Ben Kingsley was around and doing it, and they just, from what I've read anyway, embraced him wholeheartedly. So, no, he's brilliant. He's really...
Well, it's a slight irony that, you know, Gandhi's story is basically fighting independence of India against the British regime.
Yes.
And yet the people making the film are sort of probably one of the most English people you can get. And said, you know, Sir Richard Appleton, his cool name was Dickie, you know, and getting in a British Shakespearean actor to play your national hero. And originally it was Anthony Hopkins as he wanted to play.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. He had real problems casting it. It wasn't until they made up Ingenified to Ben Kingsley. I always want to call him King Bensley.
King Bensley? He would not like that.
But if I was him and I said, rather than being a knight, I'm going to change my name to King Bensley.
You can't be King and better. Sir, can you?
Sir King Bensley is much better than Ben Kingsley.
He's one of the... You hear stories about Sir Ben Kingsley where he does make you use the sir, which is a bit...
In the interviews, I've got to say, he does come across as a bit bellend.
Yeah, I don't know. I met Sir Ian McKellen and he just introduced himself as Ian. I just go, yeah, that's better, isn't it?
Yeah. Sir King Bensley.
Sir King Bensley.
If you haven't seen his performance, it is remarkable.
Fantastic, isn't it? And the scale of this film is huge. I mean, is it... I'm picking facts out of my memory hole from 15 years ago or something, but... is it 40,000 extras in one scene?
I think it's 400,000.
400,000.
They put up. They knew the film was being made in India, and it was really difficult to organise. There's those nightmarish stories, and apparently, Sir Richard Attenborough had the utmost patience and had problems with financing and just the way the Indian infrastructure there and filming in a completely different country.
Yes.
Where it's such a huge scale of events. Apparently they put adverts in the local Indian newspapers for people to attend the state funeral of Gandhi when they're filming it, because they needed a massive crowd, and it just spread like wildfire. I'm sure it's 400,000 people turned up, but you see the shots at the start of the film and it's crazy. And now, this is before, you just CGI all that, so it loses that significance,
I suppose.
And you
put in some peels of smoke to give it depth and some birds,
and
it'll all look glossy and rubbish.
But this is genuinely huge amounts of people turning up, which is, the film itself is epic, and there's always that thing when you're trying to retell a moment of history, you can't, and with such an important figure, you have to be relatively true to it. And this does treat, I know I'm not saying... You know, his name's Mahatma Gandhi. He was seen as the god of our time, I suppose. Mm. You know, and so many things stem from him, like Pacifism. You could say he was
incredible,
a
incredible achievement to actually manage to beat a state power without the use of aggression.
Yeah.
I mean, it is unique, isn't it? On that scale, I mean, it's unbelievable. It's an incredible achievement.
Yeah,
but also to convince the people who are being oppressed and brutalised that. Pacifism is the only way they're going to achieve it, and to get that many people to go with you on it is unbelievable. It's incredible.
I'm quite ignorant as to, other than seeing the film and read a few bits and bobs here, I don't know. I mean, he's portrayed as, he is obviously a national hero, how accurate the film is for a historian to look at it and say this is actually what happened.
Yes,
but it still is fascinating watching a film. It's quite an important film. And it beat, in the Oscars, it beat E.T. and Tootsie, which are two other brilliant films.
About equally important figures in history.
Aliens and cross-dressing.
Yes.
Which, in many ways, Gandhi would have been upset to lose. I mean...
He wasn't into clothes that much, was he?
E.T. and Gandhi, they used the same white blanket for both of them.
If you cross-dressed E.T...
Comes out like Gandhi.
He'd look a bit like Gandhi.
If Ben Kingsley didn't get the part, E.T. was in line... to play.
No, but Ben Kingsley would make a good E.T. I think he could do E.T.
Ben Kingsley can do anything.
Well, he can mostly play cross evil vizier these
days. That's what he does now, yeah.
Just so annoying when he's just taken the check and just go, I will be the advisor who has eyes upon the crown himself in everything.
Yeah.
It's really tedious.
He's going down that De Niro path, isn't he?
Yeah, I'm just like, oh, that sounds easy. Where's it filming? Oh, that's sunny. Yeah, I'll do that.
I think the thing about Sir Richard Attenborough was he was always interested in British film and making and a real patron of film and British arts. And I never really, when you see his documentary, see him on set, he's got that experience of an actor which he's bringing to it.
Yes.
And talking to the people, you just forget that because you're used to seeing him on the other side of the screen. So he seems to be this, for a lot of our generation, people younger than us,
yes,
we only remember him as, you know, the guy in... with Father Christmas in.
Well, exactly, and that's a tragedy, isn't it? But it's similar to how we've spoken about Robert De Niro before. You know, there's a generation now who thinks Robert De Niro's that that funny camp pirate in Stardust, you know, or whatever, you know, or he's the grumpy dad from the Meet the Parents films. You just go, oh man, oh, to die young if your career's taken that turn, you know.
We asked a few of you to put on our Facebook page your memories of Richard Attenborough, and here are a few of them now. We'll read out in different voices.
Oh, so we're going to read all
of this. So I just asked, what's your favourite films, Richard Attenborough? And here's what people wrote. Jenny Saunders says, 10 Wellington Place, hands down.
Gareth Lloyd says, the only actor who could have got away with being Father Christmas in the remake of Miracle on 34th Street.
Frank James said, well, to be honest, as a 13-year-old, the first time I clocked him was in Jurassic Park, where he steals the show with his flea circus monologue and overall warmth. And the perfect grandpa I never had. I mean, mine didn't even have a park.
Ben Painter says, surely Big X in The Great Escape, aside from the performance, just for the look on his face when he realises he isn't going back to a prison, which sums it all up brilliantly.
Edward James says, the judge in and then there were none.
Darren Rogers says, I'm in the mood, but I don't know what for exactly.
I don't think that makes sense.
It might be a quote, I don't know.
Oh.
I don't understand, Darren, explain yourself.
Benjamin Button writes, 10 Wellington Place, remembering you could do a lot more than the cuddly old man. Such slight nuance and unsettling charm, the amazing versatility, both in the front and behind the camera. Oh, what an actor!
And Eamon Martin says, the definitive Santa, Richard Attenborough, not America's Santa, Miracle on 34th Street and Jurassic Park are how people under 40 will remember him. Great performances!
Yeah, well, yeah, there we go.
He's lots of people clearly a big fan of his work.
Well, he had a great face, didn't he? I think when he plays Pinky in Broughton Rock, he's that baby-faced villain.
Yeah.
You guys just want to watch more.
You know, the Jurassic Park one is interesting because it's a slight film in terms of, you know, depth of character or anything. It's not the place for it. But his Hammond is sort of tragically just misguided and a bit. You know, he is the cause of all of these people's deaths, and yet he's still just like, oh, we just wanted a theme park that would work, you know. And interestingly, he is not that cuddly character in the book. He gets his comeuppance in trying to escape the island. He falls down a slope and breaks his leg, and then is eaten alive by tiny scavenger dinosaurs.
Oh, that's the worst way.
And if that happened to Dickie Attenborough at the end of Jurassic Park, I think we would feel a bit sorry for him.
Yeah. Those noises are Buddy the dog in the background, in case you don't know.
Yeah, it's become a bit restless. Sorry.
Is there any Richard Attenborough films you'd like to talk about?
You saw 10 Rillington Place recently. I want to hear about that, because I've wanted to see it for a while and I missed it on telly again.
Okay, well, should we do a letter section first?
Sure.
And then we'll do 10 Rillington Place. Guess who's written in? But first of all,
yeah,
I want to make contact.
Okay, well, you can email us if you have any thoughts you'd like to share with us, have your letter read out, then do email us, dearfilmfandango@gmail.com. Or you can talk to one another on facebook.com/filmfandango. Or you can talk to us on Twitter, @filmfandango, @MrDavidReed, or @MerrickLarwood. And we do all of this for free. So if you would like the podcast to keep going, if you, you know, are a regular listener and you're grateful for the fact we do this with our free time, then you can go to filmfandango.co.uk and donate towards the podcast's running costs there. And thank you to everyone who has. We would not be doing this without you.
Yeah, thanks very much. And I just can tell you who's written in.
Yeah.
I can't speak properly. Guess who's written in?
Chris Webb.
Yeah. Do you want to read what he's got to say?
I can see it in your face. He says, right, accent is Ivan Locke.
Christopher Webb is our regular, well, he hasn't been contributing much. And please do email in, because, you know, we're getting short of emails.
Yeah, but he's asked for Ivan Locke, who is Tom Hardy's character in Locke. So,
you always seem to be doing this character.
Dear chaps, firstly, apologies for not mailing you with my usual slightly disturbing frequency. It's been running round like a headless chook in preparation for the imminent arrival of Webb Jr.
Ah.
If it's a girl, Danielle. If it's a boy, either David or Marek Webb, depending on how hairy it is.
Oh.
Hmm. But this is an email about films, not babies. You've occasionally mentioned your belief that talented filmmakers tend to go off the boil when they get older. The inferior recent releases from Spielberg and Scorsese and Robert De Niro's new career as a gurner being prime examples. I recently watched a film which I think is the epitome of a filmmaker's fall from grace. Last week I saw a 2012 horror film called Twixt, starring a very chubby Val Kilmer. Maybe that's why there's a Twixt reference. As a struggling horror writer, haunted by dreams of ghosts and vampires, I wasn't expecting much, and I wasn't disappointed. With the production value somewhere between the Hallmark Channel and Rent-A-Ghost, it was absolutely appalling. I think they were trying to homage Edgar Allan Poe. I suspect this because a moustached Ben Chaplin would occasionally pop up and say, "Hello, I'm Edgar Allan Poe. Ooh, Nevermore," etc. But it was so badly acted, written and directed, I'm just grateful it was a free download from QuickFlix, and I didn't actually have to pay for it. The only genuine shock came after the final fade to black and the credits appeared. The very first credit read, "Written, produced and directed by Francis Ford Coppola." I couldn't believe the man who gave us the Godfather trilogy, The Conversation and Apocalypse Now had anything whatsoever to do with this pile of wank. It makes Bram Stoker's Dracula look like an American Werewolf in London. It even makes Jack look good. As ever, loving the podcast, and we'll keep watching the films. Chris, P.S. Happy birthday to Angelo Edwards. Yes, happy birthday, Angelo.
It must be Angelo's birthday now.
Well, hopefully by now, God.
Yeah, I think he's right about Francis Ford Coppola. He made it brilliant. He was brilliant in the 70s.
Yeah, incredible.
Started downhill in the 80s. 90s made Jack and the some rubbish court thing with Matt Damon. I did my dissertation on Francis Ford Coppola, whether
really?
He was an auteur, because I watched all of his films. He made some awful ones. For example, Tucker, A Man and His Machine or something, which is Jeff Bridges and the making of Ford cars. He's done some crap which makes you... You cannot understand how he made the gulf in his films.
Well,
in quality.
You know, I said it before, but films are, as much as we like to believe in the myth and the power of the director as author, films are collaborative. And if you're not surrounded by the best people, either, you know, the most talented director, their vision can still get lost amongst the amount of work that needs to be done, the amount of delegation that needs to be done. Or, you know, mediocre people can have their mediocre choices turned into great ones by talented people around them. You know, I mean, you've heard all the stories. Like, he's got a very limited ability in certain areas, you know, George Lucas, for instance, but... Turns out that when he first made his, you know, Star Wars films, he was surrounded by the right people who filled in the gaps in his ability so that what he was really good at could shine through.
I watched a really good documentary, which is, if this comes out on Friday,
yeah,
then it'll be on BBC 4 until Monday, on iPlayer until Monday, but if not, find it online. It's called Dangerous Days, the Making of Blade Runner.
Right.
And it shows all the problems that Ridley Scott went through. And obviously, you know, Blade Runner with the studio and the financing. And because Blade Runner wasn't really popular when it came out, and it since has become, because it was ahead of its time, regarded as, you know, one of the most beautiful films, and subsequently re-released with the director's cut and how he wanted to make it. But you see what a powerful, maybe an unrelentingly focused on his idea Ridley Scott was, which may have been difficult and to the detriment of that camaraderie on set.
Yes, but it may have been, but I mean, Ridley Scott was famous as a visuals man. He could make something look beautiful, but he isn't a stories man. And I think the more powerful he's got, the more, you know, he's been able to call all of the shots rather than be surrounded by other people. And he's got worse and worse at telling a good tale, I think.
But he talks about his... I mean, he's an artist, and you see his drawings.
Yeah.
In this documentary, it's fascinating. You see his drawings, and you see his eye. He sees the actual set as a character itself.
Yes.
And once you start seeing things from his perspective, it obviously inevitably becomes more interesting to watch the film, having seen his ideas and his visions of the future, which are the whole backdrop of that film.
Yes.
We'll catch that if you... And that shows what you... the difficulties of and almost impossible to become an auteur, really, on a huge scale thing.
Yeah,
you're dependent on so many other different inputs.
Elements.
Yeah, or inputs. people say elements, but lately you'll find a lot of people here saying inputs instead.
Okay.
So, I mean, there you go.
There you go.
There's another letter. Do you want to... I mean, you're very good at reading today, David.
Thanks, Mary. Who is it?
It's from David Crowshaw. That sounds like a good name, like something out of Krull.
Krull. David Crowshaw. Two A's. Gotta love a two
A's
in
there's
something.
Three A's in total, innit?
Yeah, but two next to each other. Shaw.
If you want to make your name sound better, just double up the A's.
David Reed.
David Reed.
Yeah.
Marek Norwood. He just says, I'm here. I'm going to dominate.
Hi, David and Marek.
You're going to do all the A's doubled, right?
Yes. I wish A, bring A. That was even a mistyped A. That doesn't even need it.
He's got so many, A's, in his name, he can't stop hitting that A button.
Yeah. I wish to bring a new US show to your attention, as I think if Marek will find it fascinating. It's called The Chair, and it's a 10-part documentary about two-time directors making an independent film, both using the same source material. They must keep the character names the same, and the location can't be changed. I have only seen the first two episodes, and I am loving finding out about all the hard work that goes into making an independent film. Also, I have a film I wish to recommend. Mary and Max. Love the podcast. As I work in an indie record shop that also sells films, it can be hard to choose which one to buy next, so your recommendations help me a lot.
And then he's inserted a cheeky plug for his record shop, which is facebook.com/headbromley. So, Mary and Max. I have not heard of this film. Have you heard of this?
I don't know.
Mary and Max. Maryandmax.com is the link.
Where does he work? Head Bromley.
Yes, I've not heard of The Chair either.
No, so we'll try and watch The Chair. Sounds like a really good, fascinating documentary. So thank you very much, David. I mean, that was pretty fun to read, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was great fun.
Oh, it's Mary Max is a claymated feature film.
Oh, wow. Modern?
Yeah, 2009. So that looks like a good... And it's in the top... It's number 172 in the top 250 films of all time.
As rated by whom?
IMDb.
Oh, wow.
And Tony Collette and Philip Seymour Hoffman have done... voiced it as well. Eric Banner, rather. So I came up with the And Barry Humphries is the narrator. That looks fascinating.
Let's watch Mary and Max then.
Yeah, let's do that sometime. That sounds good. Thank you very much for your email. So now I'm going to talk about the other film. Which Attenborough film?
Yes, please.
Sorry, David Attenborough.
No, Dickie, not David.
Which is, as we mentioned a couple of times, 10 Rillington Place. It's a story of John Christie. So for people who don't know, he was a famous serial killer in the 1950s in London, and like Gandhi as well, this film's got the case got huge historical significance. So you don't know the story, I suppose you're going to have spoilers. It was a guy who was wrongly hanged for it, which changed the whole death penalty law and was fundamental to the end of Pierre Point the Hangman and the end of pretty much the end of the death penalty
in this country.
Yeah. So it's a story of this set in Notting Hill, when Notting Hill was pretty much a horrible slum, and the film is, I think they knocked the house down, so the film was shot in the house two doors down.
Oh wow.
So you're shooting in the place where it looked, you know, it looked, it's exactly the same. They said the atmosphere was quite I think the problem was that the family were living in, people were living in 10 Rillington Place, they wouldn't rent it out,
right?
So they had to go two doors down.
I don't think I'd want the film crew to recreate murders that happened in the house I was living in.
They normally knock them down now.
Yeah.
Well, I live around.
Do they? Is that right?
Yeah. But I live around the corner from, is it Dennis Nielsen, the guy in London?
Okay.
In Muswell Hill, killed with the people. And that house they continue on, it's on for sale again now for about 80 grand less than it normally is. Yeah,
that's probably why they knock it down, don't they?
Yeah, because you can't
get value rid of the curse.
But this one's in a flat, you see, so someone who lives in the basement, you can't just knock the top off it.
Would
you
live in the basement?
That's why he put their bodies down the drains, because he didn't have anywhere to bury them when he moved from somewhere else. Anyway, that's a separate serial killer. This is the story of John Christie, who is this sort of ex sort of war policeman, sort of quietly spoken northern bloke. Apparently had problems with his throat, so he can only speak like this, so he's very, very quiet.
Alan Bennett.
He does sound a bit like Alan Bennett. Alan Bennett got his personality from this serial killer. And he rents out rooms in his flat in Temlington Place. And a young couple, played by Judy Geeson, who's not really done so much since, and John Hurt, move in with their baby, and terrible things happen.
Right.
And this film is very, very bleak and depressing and spooky.
And true.
And true. So it has an added sort of depth of horror to it.
I've wanted to see it for a while. It's one of those.
It is absolutely brilliant. Richard Attenborough, I've always thought of him as well. You know, Pinky, you see him being slightly sinister. You know him for that sort of smiley, bearded man from later on. You watch him in this and you think, what an actor.
Well, because his most famous performances tend to be in, with the exception of Miracle on 34th Street, they tend to be ensemble, big ensemble pieces, don't they? You know, so actually having one where he's the focus.
But you see the influence of this. There's something about, because the guy, John Christie, had some throat problems, so he couldn't ever shout, or he was disturbed, or some sort of problem. So it's all very, very quiet. And so he's sort of talking a bit like this. He's really, really creepy. And Richard Attenborough's not scared to look ugly and horrible. He's not scared to be that sort of repulsive person. And you see shades of Hannibal Lecter and that quietness that Anthony Hopkins has got. You know, he's very measured and very sort of clipped. You almost think, oh, that this influenced or had some influence on that, or maybe did or didn't. I knew they were friends in real life and worked together, but it feels like a huge influence on that.
Yeah,
the performance is brilliant. I think, I don't know if he won an Oscar for it or not, but he should. No, he didn't, but it's terrifying in its normality, and it's just a really run down house. And a man and his wife who sort of suspects what's going on, and they've got a really mundane, normal life. He's got this horrific, dark side to him where he ends up killing women and ruins another man's life. And there's a few confrontation scenes between John Hurt and Richard Attenborough. John Hurt plays Timothy Evans, who, and there's going to be spoilers here, so please stop and watch the film now.
Want to hear spoilers.
This is a spoiler, but Timothy Evans was basically wrongly convicted of the murder of his wife and child. Sorry, you don't want to hear them. But so it's a famous case. We have him trying to convince, after he's done the act, he's trying to speak to Timothy Evans about it, trying to convince him not to hand himself in. And Timothy Evans is quite a slow sort of Welsh guy. He doesn't, an innocent and naive, that he doesn't know what to do and is panicked. And there's some really fascinating scenes between, you don't really see as much now in sort of serial killers dramas. It just seems a bit
it almost feels like
over-dramatised, and
every serial killer now has to be Kevin Spacey from Seven.
Yes.
Where you're just like, I'm talking in a creepy way now, but I'm sort of like a Bond villain.
It's all done in that sort of, this is so mundane that it's more terrifying, and the character's really mundane and normal, and slightly sick and pervy, and it takes a good actor to pull it off and not worry. Like Philip Seymour Hoffman, he plays ugly sort of characters.
Well, there's a lot of vanity acting goes on where people think, well, I want to get the character right, but I also don't want to look ugly. I want to be beautiful in every frame of this. You know, and I think the best actors aren't afraid of that. You're quite right. Because most people aren't beautiful, are they?
Yes, I mean, a lot of them on the inside. Because it's a famous historical case, one of those films where you watch the film and you'll read up about it on the internet and find out just how fascinating just been watching a history program, really.
Yeah, yeah.
So well, I highly recommend it. But it's very, very bleak, but beautifully filmed and terrifying in its mundanity. I'm going to say it. I'll just basically repeat myself over again.
Is it the best performance you've seen him do, do you think?
I liked him in Brighton Rock. I'm not a big fan of his later sort of beardy, smiley performances, but I thought this was sensational.
Okay.
Interesting enough, I watched a Hitchcock film around the time, which is Frenzy, which is about a serial killer as well, which is 1972.
Right.
Which is set in Covent Garden, which is almost comical in that you sort of see the old Hitchcock with a new colour of, and there's elements of the old, the beautiful shots of Hitchcock, really beautiful, sinister shots, and also some terrible shots as well, but strangely, and it's really, has got questionable, it's really sexist in places, and has aged the film. But that's another fascinating serial killer thing. And you watch those two films, and now, and I watched a documentary about that with my friend Paul Allen, and they were saying there weren't many serial killer films around this time. And now the serial killer genre is huge. But so in retrospect, it's difficult watching them. But because you think, oh, it's another serial killer film. But these were two sort of quite unusual films at the time to have these sort of slightly sexual serial killer films, which become obsessed with.
It's a less well-known one, Frenzy, isn't it? Less celebrated, perhaps.
But I thought at the time, is it rubbish? It's really stayed with me and has 10 Riddington Place. So if you really want to get yourself in the mood for the 70s and feel quite depressed and see two very enjoyable serial killer films, why not have 10 Riddington Place and Frenzy Dog Bill?
Invite,
watch it with your girlfriend.
Or your neighbours who moved in next door and their baby, invite them round.
If you're renting a flat in your house, just have that on.
As you show people around.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's enough for this week, probably, isn't it?
Yeah, but yeah. I think we just vaguely go Rich Annenberg, but if we're for a change, we do something.
Why not?
But I would highly recommend 10 Riddington Place. I'm sorry if this bored is, but it is a huge part of British history, so I don't feel too bad.
Okay. Well, we'll be back next week with yet more films. Keep watching the films. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.